From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. It's hard to get a private investigator on the phone.
I'm actually in the middle of surveillance, and my girl should be leaving from work any minute.
Especially one who's currently on a stakeout.
Yeah, no, I need to focus because I've got I'm eyes on her car, and I got to call another investigator right when she comes out to catch her.
Eventually, with one eye still on her target, she calls me back.
How's your day?
Day's been great. It's been activity after activity.
Sometimes a company will hire her to investigate an employee for misconduct, or a family will hire her to track down a missing loved one.
I do a lot of fraud. I do a lot of missing person cases, and then I do hard serves.
Hard serves are not the opposite of soft serve. It's when someone being sued is handed a manila envelope and told, you've been served. And this PI specializes in delivering legal documents to people who are especially hard to serve. Millionaires, celebrities, government people. And I wanted to ask her about one particular hard serve.
So the subject was Gota, and forgive me, I can't not remember his last name.
His full name, Gotabaya Rajapaksa.
Yep, that's him.
And he isn't like the PI's regular targets.
You know, what he's accused of and just all of it. There's just so much.
He was Sri Lanka's defense secretary from 2005 to 2015 and has been accused of committing war crimes to end the civil war there.
He's scary, and those he associates with seem scary. And when you get into those high-profile people, you don't know what they're capable of.
Scary enough that she wanted to remain anonymous.
It did alarm me, but it also made me feel compelled to do this for the families.
Families suing him. The PI was hired to put their lawsuit in his hands. Now she just has to find him. But he's not making it especially hard. Even tweeting about singing karaoke with his friends in an upscale LA suburb. Hashtag downtime, hashtag Sri Lankan music. She stakes him out, waiting for just the right moment.
Then we were able to get him when they left and then follow him to Trader Joe's.
Yes, like many Americans, on this Sunday, April 7th, 2019, the former Sri Lankan defense secretary and his family are making a grocery run.
He's just a passenger in a regular car, and we're going to Trader Joe's. Okay.
The Rajapaksa family walks through the parking lot towards the entrance of the Trader Joe's in Montrose, California, just north of L.A. The former military leader is in his late 60s. He's wearing khakis and a maroon long-sleeve button-up, gray military-grade haircut, and a mustache common to South Asian men of his age. The PI is checking for counter-surveillance, a Secret Service detail. But Rajapaksa seems surprisingly unprotected.
So he didn't have an entourage of people around him to protect him, so that was what I was thinking was going to happen.
Seeing none, the PI proceeds.
When I got out, I called for his name, and when I called his name, he turned around. And then when I walked up to him, I noticed his wife was looking at me. Who is this person? And I went to hand him the envelope, and he reached out to receive it. And as soon as I said, you've been served, he quickly pulled his hand behind his back.
What was the look on his face?
Shocked. Both him and his wife looked shocked. Since he refused to take it, I just dropped him at his feet, told him he's been served, and then walked away. And as I walked away, I reminded him again, you need to take those papers. They're legal documents. You've been served.
The PI's partner, waiting near the car, captured this moment on tape.
We got you on tape, sir. You gotta take them. You've been served. Good job. Good job. Good job. Come on. Let's go.
The whole 15-second scene is so chaotic and bizarre and baffling. Rajapaksa is a military leader facing war crimes accusations. But this isn't some federal SWAT team swooping in with handcuffs to haul him off to The Hague. It's a private investigator serving civil lawsuits in the parking lot of a grocery store that has those tiny free cups of coffee. I've spent the past 6 months investigating why the U.S. fails to charge accused perpetrators of the worst crimes in the world. The federal government says they are pursuing leads and cases against nearly 1,700 alleged human rights violators and war criminals who are right here, living among us. 1,700. Reveal has filed FOIAs. Our lawyers have sued for government records. We've talked with ambassadors, federal prosecutors, federal historians, and, of course, the victims of atrocities themselves, to understand why they almost never see justice. Today on the show, why are alleged war criminals and human rights violators almost never criminally charged in the U.S.? Try to imagine living through one of the most horrific, brutal periods of violence anywhere, managing to survive, moving across the world, and just as you're starting to build your new life in the U.S., the person who tortured you or disappeared your family is right in front of you. Survivors tell stories that feel like nightmares. A Guatemalan woman seeing the militia leader she believes disappeared her father and uncle right there in line behind her at a Walgreens in Providence, Rhode Island. A Somali man who stops at his local coffee shop in Alexandria, Virginia, only to spot the warlord who he says killed his family. An Ethiopian woman in Atlanta who catches a glimpse of her torturer as he steps into an elevator in a hotel lobby. And in that Trader Joe's parking lot in Montrose, there was Gotabaya Rajapaksa, a Sri Lankan man who human rights groups accuse of ordering torture, white van abductions, disappearances, and overseeing the Sri Lankan armed forces as they shelled civilian areas, resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands. But in that parking lot, the legal documents the private investigator dropped at Rajapaksa's feet outline one killing in particular, a Sri Lankan journalist who is one of the government's fiercest critics, Lasantha Wickramathunga. Shortly after his death in 2009, the BBC asked Rajapaksa about Lasantha's killing. Here's the former defense secretary.
There are so many murders in everywhere, in the whole world there are murders. Why are you asking about Lasantha? Who is Lasantha?
So, why are we talking about the killing of one journalist during a civil war that took the lives of 100,000 people? And one reason is that Lasantha's death effectively stopped the Sri Lankan press from covering all the other killings to come.
It's often called a war without witness, those last 5 months. And of course there were no witnesses, because all of us had been silenced. Lasantha's murder, just before the final push, made sure of that.
I spoke with Darisha Bastians, who is a hard-hitting Sri Lankan journalist. But back in 2004, she was just a cub reporter when she went to interview for a job at the Sunday Leader in the capital city of Colombo. And she still lights up, remembering meeting its legendary editor-in-chief.
For me, meeting Lasantha alone was this huge thing, because I was very shy. I am very shy. And Lasantha is this larger-than-life figure.
He made a career of spotlighting corruption, hypocrisy, and scandal among the most powerful people in the country.
He was so provocative that governments hated him.
Like, really hated him. He'd been pulled out of his car and beaten with bats, shot at, and a former minister, while in parliament, threatened to have him killed. Lasantha could have fled the country with his three children, but he stayed. And for Darisha, it was like being interviewed by a journalism folk hero.
It was a real moment to meet this guy, right? And so I was very surprised that he had this soft voice and he giggled a lot.
A tough, adversarial journalist who had a soft spot for mentoring young reporters who wanted to learn how to hold the powerful accountable. Darisha got the job.
as soon as I joined, I was so confused. He kept eating our lunch. And he would just walk around the office stealing everybody's pens. And I was like, wow, this is so strange. Because this is this man who's taking on, you know, the establishment. And here he is chewing on my pen.
Lasantha and her new colleagues at the Sunday Leader helped her learn how to cover the biggest stories in the country. But for Darisha, there was only one.
No other story, whether it was corruption or anything else I was covering, compared to covering the human cost of the war. When you talk to people, when you see people, it's like the civil war was written on their faces. You know, the story of our war was written all over these people's faces.
The story begins in 1983.
The mobs were coming out. They started attacking anything and everything they saw, which were Tamil.
There had been plenty of riots before, but this was different. A state-sponsored pogrom.
An ethnic attack, or pogrom, against the Tamil minority. It was an event that interrupted the normal timeline of Sri Lankan history. There was before 83, and then there was after.
The civil war had begun.
It was a conflict between the Sri Lankan military, controlled by the Sinhalese majority, and a guerrilla army known as the Tamil Tigers, or LTTE, who were fighting for a separate Tamil state. But the lines in civil wars are never that bright. My family is Sri Lankan Tamil, and my mom and brother were in Colombo when Sinhalese rioters burned down the house my mom grew up in. They left the country not long after that. My aunt is Sinhalese, and she stayed and was pregnant with my cousin when suicide bombers blew up the bank she was working in. They survived what was one of the deadliest attacks attributed to the Tigers. The war went back and forth for more than two decades. Terrorist-style attacks and repressive government crackdowns. 20 million civilians lived through it, including Darisha.
I was born into a generation that had only known war. My generation didn't know a country, a Sri Lanka, that was not at war.
Some of the island's best coverage of the war came from Lasantha's paper, critical of the Tigers and the Sri Lankan government. And then, in 2005, a new administration stepped in. Mahinda Rajapaksa was elected president of Sri Lanka, and he made his brother Gotabaya the Secretary of Defense. They promised to take a hard line on the Tigers. Journalists came under a new level of scrutiny, too. Still, Lasantha approached the new administration the only way he knew how. In 2007, his paper published an investigative series alleging Gotabaya Rajapaksa bought expired fighter planes at an inflated price. And the defense secretary responded by suing Lasantha. Soon after, a masked gang stormed the Sunday Leader and set their printing press on fire. But Darisha tells me Lasantha didn't slow down.
He was the kind of journalist, the more you attack him, the harder he goes at you.
He was scheduled to testify in court in early 2009 about Rajapaksa's alleged role in the corrupt arms deal. But shortly before, heavily armed assailants raided a major independent broadcaster where Lasantha hosted a TV show. He showed up just after the attack and talked directly into a camera. What you are about to hear are Lasantha's last recorded words.
I wholeheartedly condemn this terroristic attack. What we are seeing is a Pol Pot type of regime trying to establish a dictatorship. They do not care for another point of view. They only want the people to blindly agree with all that is happening in this country. There is a total disregard for human rights. But we as media personnel will have to face up to this challenge by expressing what is happening in this country, giving all shades of opinion their due place without being intimidated into silence by the jackboot of a dictatorship.
2 days later, on the morning of January 8th, 2009, according to court documents, Lasantha noticed men dressed in black riding motorcycles around his home in Colombo. He called his friends and family to say he thought he was being watched. Still, he got in his car and headed to work. When he arrived at a busy intersection, the men on motorcycles swarmed. Court records say they smashed his windows and punched a hole in Lasantha's skull with a sharp instrument. Darisha found out and turned on the TV.
I just remember sitting there, completely shell-shocked, and just watching these images of him on a stretcher, this man who was larger than life, and I couldn't recognize him. I think I was too shocked or scared or horrified to even cry, and about 15 minutes later, I got another text saying he didn't survive.
Still, Lasantha managed to have the last word. In a posthumous essay that was reprinted around the world, he predicted his own death and named the people he thought would kill him. Here's Darisha reading Lasantha's final essay.
I hope my assassination will be seen not as a defeat of freedom, but an inspiration for those who survived to step up their efforts. Indeed, I hope that it will galvanize forces that will usher in a new era of human liberty in our beloved motherland. I also hope it will open the eyes of your president to the fact that however many are slaughtered in the name of patriotism, the human spirit will endure and flourish. Not all the Rajapaksas combined can kill that.
Thousands of mourners filled the streets. They demanded that the killers be held accountable. But this outpouring of resistance only lasted a moment.
I just constantly felt that Lasantha had 9 lives. And it just felt like if he wasn't going to survive this regime, none of us were.
And then the Sri Lankan government began the worst escalation of violence in the history of the conflict. It has become the subject of international outrage, multiple UN resolutions, and more than a decade-long campaign aimed at holding leaders accountable. First, the Sri Lankan government kicked out international observers. And when they were gone, the military repeatedly targeted civilian hospitals. Reporters confronted Rajapaksa about it.
No hospital should operate in the area. Nothing should operate. That is why we clearly gave these no-fire zone.
After Tamil Tigers and their families tried to surrender, holding only white flags, they were allegedly killed by Sri Lankan troops. One headline about a 12-year-old boy read, "Handed a snack and then executed." The Sri Lankan government claimed few innocent people died in those final days of fighting. The UN estimates that as many as 40,000 civilians were killed. At the end of the war, most of the surviving Tamil population was herded onto a beach the size of Central Park. They carried the only things they had left. One man had a plastic bag with his child's body in it. Rajapaksa was the Secretary of Defense who oversaw this campaign. And even after the war, Tamils kept disappearing. A BBC reporter asked him why.
These are wrong allegations.
They're not wrong allegations because I've met the victims.
Don't get angry. You know, usually I get angry, so you don't get angry. Okay? I'm the Secretary of Defense. Take the word from me.
To the people on their side, they were war heroes. and allegations of war crimes had made no progress in Sri Lankan courts. For people who believed Rajapaksa was responsible for war crimes, they had one last hope: the U.S. courts. Rajapaksa was a U.S. citizen. Before the war, his family had settled here. The U.S. was home. And after the war, he came back often. Here he is in 2019, singing karaoke with his friends in Southern California. It's not just Rajapaksa. The U.S. government says it has leads on close to 1,700 suspected war criminals and human rights violators who are here. What are they doing about it? That's next on Reveal.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program to bring you a special bulletin.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting, this is Jim Briggs
and Fernando Arruda. We're the sound designers behind Reveal.
Each week,
we create an album of original music for every single episode.
We like to think thematically and create music that will help listeners understand the story.
It's all available for download. You can find it at revealnews.bandcamp.com. Thanks for listening.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sreeskandaraja. Just this month, atrocities in Ukraine have triggered new allegations of war crimes. Images from the town of Bucha showed civilians with their wrists bound, lying dead in the streets. Regular people living their normal lives until the laws of reality around them suddenly change. The combination of the scale and depravity of violence is shocking. These moments often get their own name. The Rwandan genocide, Srebrenica, Dos Eres, Ethiopia's Red Terror, Haiti's Rabito massacre. Alleged perpetrators from many of the world's worst atrocities, including all those I just mentioned, have been found inside the United States. So, what is the U.S. government doing about it? Americans first demanded a solution to this problem after World War II.
The United States is currently a haven for hundreds of war criminals.
Scores of Nazi persecutors entered the U.S.
You were a propagandist for the Nazis. Then you became an informer for the U.S. Army.
Yes.
Intelligence.
Yes.
For decades, they lived untouched by the United States government, even though there was evidence available against them.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service was supposed to be investigating Nazi persecutors, but they weren't doing a great job.
The lack of action by the Immigration Service became the subject of congressional hearings.
And by 1974, Congress pushed them on it.
Representative Elizabeth Holtzman.
Finally, I asked the immigration commissioner about this at a hearing. And I said to him, is it true that there are Nazi war criminals in the United States? And he said, yes, we have a list of alleged Nazi war criminals in this country. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? And there was silence.
In 1979, President Jimmy Carter announced a solution.
The world must never forget the lessons of the Holocaust. That is exactly the reason why I set up a special unit in the Department of Justice to root out Nazi war criminals who may be in hiding in the United States.
And so, in a dilapidated building in the middle of D.C.'s red light district on 14th Street, just above a fried chicken restaurant, a new Department of Justice Nazi hunting unit was born. And Eli Rosenbaum was there almost right at the beginning.
It took our own country nearly 30 years from when the first World War II Nazi criminal was found in the United States to finally launch in 1979 a comprehensive program to identify, investigate, and prosecute the cases.
Eli's own father had fled Nazi Germany, escaping the Holocaust. Later, he returned as part of the U.S. forces that liberated concentration camps. Now, Eli was tasked with finding the suspects who ran those camps. DOJ's Nazi hunters, officially known as the Office of Special Investigations, were investigating crimes that happened long ago, far away, with evidence in foreign languages. But the new office had a secret weapon.
Specifically for us at Justice, we had the good sense back in 1979, at the very beginning, to start hiring historians.
I talked with four of those historians. These Nazi hunters, armed not with a gun and a cruiser, but a Stax pass and desk privileges at the Library of Congress, they turned out to be the key.
They have the language skills. They have the archival research skills, the interpretive skills to look at a document that might mean almost nothing to most of us, but they see a code that they recognize, a German military code like 03, what kind of officer in what unit. They know all that stuff.
They would visit dusty archives, hunched over barely legible documents, gathering Nazi personnel files. Then they would run those names against U.S. immigration records and zero in on Nazi criminals here.
These cases are usually very complex evidentiary jigsaw puzzles, and everybody plays a role in assembling the puzzle. Historians, lawyers, agents, analysts, everybody.
And it was working.
In January alone, four new cases entered the courtroom phase in this country.
Some of the testimony, for the first time ever, has been taken in the Soviet Union.
A resident of Miami is now charged with lying about his background as an SS guard at Treblinka concentration camp.
The office had a rogues gallery up on the wall, showing the faces of more than 100 former Nazis they prosecuted. But it didn't mean these Nazis were being hauled off to jail.
There was no criminal law in the United States covering crimes that were committed outside the United States by the Nazis during World War II.
It's worth repeating. The greatest crime in the 20th century was not a crime in the United States. And this led to some very frustrating moments in Eli's line of work.
In the 1990s, I questioned a suspect of ours, Jacob Reimer. He lived north of New York City and came into the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. And by the end of the interview, under oath, he had admitted to leading a platoon of his men on a mission to, as he described it, liquidate a labor camp.
Even though he had a confession, Eli couldn't arrest him.
All we could do was bid him farewell to go back out of the building and take Metro North home. I remember thinking if he had so much as slapped a security guard on the way in, we could get him arrested. But he had admitted to participation in genocide, mass murder, and the law just wasn't there. Just wasn't there for us. And so we were left with civil jurisdiction, revocation of citizenship, known as denaturalization and deportation.
Denaturalization and deportation, meaning all those cases, the intricate historical investigations, the nationwide manhunts, they only resulted in immigration charges. Since Eli couldn't charge Nazis with committing atrocities, he charged them with lying on immigration paperwork. Prosecutors have a name for this.
So the Al Capone theory is near and dear to the hearts of prosecutors. It's named after the notorious gangster of the Prohibition era of the 20th century. He was a mass murderer. In the end, what the Department of Justice was able to prove was just tax evasion.
Al Capone served time in Alcatraz, but the Nazi platoon leader who told Eli he participated in the liquidation of a labor camp, that guy never saw the inside of a prison. He died while the U.S. was trying to find a country to deport him to. If this seems like an inadequate punishment to you, you're not alone.
I'd like to speak briefly on that subject.
It was also frustrating to members of Congress.
Let me just take a minute to say, what is genocide? It is the most vicious, the most cruel, the most terrible crime imaginable.
By 1988, Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin had given something like 3,000 speeches pushing the U.S. to pass a genocide statute. And then, right before he retired,
the Genocide Convention Implementation Act of 1988 clears the way, at long last, for the United States to finally approve the Genocide Convention.
President Ronald Reagan signed the law criminalizing the intentional destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group.
And with this passage, we'll end a 40-year congressional stalemate.
The U.S. was late to the Human Rights Party, but it was starting to catch up. The genocide statute created in response to the Holocaust was the first so-called substantive human rights statute. And a few years later, in the wake of atrocities in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur, Congress passed new statutes: criminal laws against torture in 1994, war crimes in 1996, and the recruitment of child soldiers in 2008. The old Nazi hunting unit was reassigned to now investigate modern human rights violators. ICE started their own war crimes unit. Then the laws, the teams, and the new mandate all came together for a historic first.
This marks the first time the Department of Justice has indicted an individual with torture charges.
DOJ successfully prosecuted Charles Taylor Jr. for torture. And in 2009, a Florida judge sentenced Chucky, the son of the former Liberian president, to 97 years in federal prison. This case showed what it looks like when the U.S. uses the full force of federal law enforcement and a substantive human rights law to hold a violator accountable. But senators wanted to know, what's next?
Successful prosecution of Chucky Taylor was an important milestone, and I hope it will send a message to perpetrators of human rights abuses that the United States will not turn a blind eye towards torture and other egregious human rights violations.
At this Senate hearing called No Safe Haven, Russ Feingold pressed a top DOJ official representing the human rights section.
But it is absolutely unacceptable that this is the only human rights case that has been filed by the DOJ. It's not enough to give lip service to these principles or to simply pass laws that are never enforced. We need to make sure that these cases are aggressively and proactively investigated and prosecuted.
This hearing was back in 2009. So what has the DOJ done since? Earlier this year, I got on a video call with leaders at the Department of Justice. The old Nazi hunting unit grew into the Human Rights and Special Prosecutions section. Hope Olds is their acting chief.
We are a small section made up of 25 attorneys and 5 historians with expertise in various conflicts and language abilities. We handle a variety of matters, including human rights abuse cases, as well as international violent crime and international human smuggling matters.
The government says it has leads on nearly 1,700 suspected war criminals and human rights violators inside the U.S. And I wanted to know how many of them the DOJ is pursuing.
In terms of the human rights portfolio, can you tell us how many cases you all are investigating right now?
That was something I addressed.
The public affairs officer on the line interrupts. She says they can't answer that.
Because we don't discuss ongoing investigations.
I got a similar answer when I tried to ask about Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the former Sri Lankan Secretary of Defense accused of war crimes.
I'm sorry, we're not going to discuss non-public cases.
They can't discuss ongoing investigations. They can't discuss non-public cases. So I turned to the ones they can talk about.
I wanted to go over the criminal substantive statutes that are on the books. Has the U.S. ever charged someone with war crimes?
No.
Has the U.S. ever charged someone with genocide?
No.
How about the recruitment of child soldiers?
No.
And torture?
Yes.
Why has the U.S. only successfully prosecuted one person for human rights violations?
Hope, do you want to talk about how DOJ decides to bring criminal charges against human rights violators?
Can I just say...
At this point, one of the original Nazi hunters, Eli Rosenbaum, who's also on the call, jumps in.
There are far more than one successful criminal prosecution of human rights violators. Quite a few that our office prosecuted.
Eli says the DOJ does win prosecutions against war criminals and human rights violators just on lesser charges, that Al Capone strategy. They also wanted me to know that recently they have announced a new charge under the torture statute. It's the second one in the last 2 years. Both of those cases are pending. But still, 30 years of human rights statutes and just one conviction. Every Nazi persecutor and almost every modern-day abuser of human rights who has faced a charge has only been accused of lying on their immigration forms. And when people are deported, they sometimes rise to power in the very countries where they're accused of committing atrocities in the first place. One man, after being removed from the U.S. for using child soldiers, was then elected to the House of Representatives in Liberia. Another, who is facing lawsuits here in the U.S. over war crimes allegations, attempted a run for president of Libya. Then there's Gotabaya Rajapaksa, accused of ordering torture, murder, and mass atrocities in Sri Lanka.
You are talking all the time on the past, no? I am trying to become the president of the future Sri Lanka.
Up next, how a small group of nonprofit lawyers tries to do a government-sized job.
We sue war criminals because our government doesn't prosecute them.
That's coming up on Reveal.
I know it's hard. You wait all week for this podcast, and then it's over, and you find yourself wanting more. Let me make a recommendation. The Reveal newsletter. It goes behind the scenes into how we make and report these stories. Subscribe now at revealnews.org/newsletter.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. During the very first session of the very first Congress, the United States passed what would become a key to modern human rights law, though nobody knew it for about 200 years. Tucked into the Judiciary Act of 1789 was a brief provision known as the Alien Tort Statute. It was meant to provide a solution to thorny problems with unclear jurisdiction. Basically, it made it possible to sue pirates in a U.S. federal court, or any foreigner in violation of the law of nations. You could miss it if you blinked, and most did until about 1979. That's when a family who fled from Paraguay to New York learned the person they accused of torturing their son to death was also here. Some creative lawyers helped them sue this man in civil court by reincarnating that antique pirate law. And they won. A judge ruled the torturer has become like the pirate and slave trader before him, an enemy of all mankind. That precedent is the main reason why the former Sri Lankan military leader, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, could be served a lawsuit in that Trader Joe's parking lot. The family of killed journalist Lasantha Wickramathunga sued him with help from a nonprofit.
We were contacted by a representative of Lasantha's family.
Carmen Chung runs the Center for Justice and Accountability. Five lawyers who sue alleged war criminals on behalf of the families they're accused of persecuting. And they've never lost a trial.
We've brought about 24 cases. And in those 24 cases, our clients have been awarded damages of over $700 million.
Oh my God, that's...
Yeah.
A staggering sum. But with the exception of one former Haitian death squad leader who had won the Florida lottery, those damages are almost never collected. Usually the accused don't have it, or they leave the country without paying. But Carmen says for her clients, that's not the point. They want accountability. They want closure. They want a court of law to acknowledge what happened to them. And if the criminal justice system isn't going to provide that, that's where they step in.
We sue war criminals because our government doesn't prosecute them.
Their lawsuit contains evidence about Lasantha's killing, including findings from a Sri Lankan police investigation that tracked the alleged killer's cell phones as they fled the scene of the crime.
The cell phone evidence that we've been able to obtain will forensically demonstrate that this group of assassins basically just fled into a compound that was military access only.
Police identified the alleged assassins as part of a military intelligence unit linked to other attacks on journalists, all while under the command of Defense Secretary Gotabaya Rajapaksa. Just as Carmen's team is building the case against Rajapaksa, they learn their window to sue him in the U.S. is quickly closing. Rajapaksa, remember, is an American citizen. And Carmen's team hears that he's making one last trip to California. The rumor is he plans to renounce his U.S. citizenship so he can run for president of Sri Lanka.
And so we really saw this as our only chance to bring a case against him.
Carmen's team had been sharing information with different agencies inside the U.S. government. Federal officials knew they were tracking Rajapaksa. And then, right before they were about to serve this lawsuit, they checked back one last time.
I mean, we told them what we were doing.
With no indication that DOJ would bring charges, they moved.
We got you on tape, sir. You gotta take them. You've been served.
Good job. Come on. Let's go.
Several human rights lawyers described the same experience. They share evidence with the human rights section at DOJ, hoping their lawsuits will trigger federal investigations and criminal charges. But one of them told me it feels like passing information into a black box.
I very much empathize with that point of view.
I talked with one former DOJ prosecutor who used to work inside that black box.
I think that's probably exactly what it looks like to NGOs that are doing a lot of work gathering evidence.
Mona Sahaf was a prosecutor at the Human Rights Section until 2021. For 6 years, she was in a key position to hold human rights violators accountable. But she isn't able to talk about any of those cases.
I don't think any of my human rights cases became public, so I don't have one to talk about, unfortunately. I did some investigations, you know, some that were closed, some that are still ongoing on the human rights side, but didn't end up charging anything.
We know the DOJ never charged Rajapaksa, but what happened to the evidence that was shared with them? Did they investigate him for war crimes?
So anything that I worked on that's non-public, I can't, you know, discuss, I can't comment on its existence or non-existence, unfortunately.
Should they have investigated him?
Can we turn off the recording for a second?
Mona can't say anything else. deciding whether or not to bring a case often hinges on one critical question. Is it important enough for the U.S. government to get involved? And Mona says when the government weighs all the interests it has to balance around the world, human rights cases aren't at the top of the list.
Bringing human rights cases and bringing accountability to the victims of human rights abuses is just not our number one priority.
If bringing accountability to the victims of human rights abuses was truly the number one priority, this work would look a lot different. U.S. human rights laws are still lagging behind the rest of the world. We don't have a Crimes Against Humanity statute, the law that was first used at Nuremberg and this year led to the conviction of a Syrian colonel in Germany. We don't have that law here. And the list of atrocities that the U.S. military and government leaders have been accused of committing rivals anywhere else in the world. Every major human rights violation you can think of. And none of the alleged perpetrators of those crimes were ever charged under substantive human rights statutes. DOJ veteran Eli Rosenbaum has dedicated his life to holding perpetrators of atrocities accountable. He deeply understands how important and how frustrating this work can be.
I would say the fact that the vast majority of human rights violators from World War II until now have not been brought to justice is really the great human rights tragedy of the post-war world, right? These crimes must never again be committed. And yet the crimes have continued to be perpetrated. Genocide, war crimes, all the worst human rights violations. And so we ended up with the worst possible scenario, which is that someone taking part in these crimes probably knows that in all likelihood, he or she will get away with it.
So what about the civil case against Gotabaya Rajapaksa? After those legal documents were dropped at his feet in April 2019, he finished his grocery trip and soon got on a plane back to Sri Lanka, where he renounced his U.S. citizenship.
I'm only a Sri Lankan citizen. I have solved this matter legally.
Mounted a presidential campaign.
Those campaigning for Gotabaya Rajapaksa say he's a terminator, but won't be an authoritarian leader.
And then
Gotabaya Rajapaksa has claimed victory in the Sri Lankan presidential election.
Gotabaya Rajapaksa was elected president of Sri Lanka on November 17th, 2019.
I love my country. I'm proud of my country. And I have a vision for the future of this country.
We tried to talk with President Rajapaksa, but his press office declined our request. More than a decade after overseeing the brutal end of Sri Lanka's civil war, and months after being sued, Rajapaksa gained presidential immunity. While he's in office, he can't be sued. The closest he has ever come to facing allegations against him was being handed those documents in that Trader Joe's parking lot. I reached out to Ahimsa Wickramathunga, daughter of journalist Lasantha Wickramathunga. I asked her about what the U.S. government's decision not to bring charges meant to her. And she wrote this back. I continue to be astounded by the fact that despite overwhelming evidence against him and clear responsibility in heinous atrocities committed in Sri Lanka, the U.S. government never prosecuted him. I think that sends a powerful message to dictators and war criminals all over the world that brutality and murder will have few repercussions in the United States. It is senseless and it is infuriating. As we were getting ready to release this story, President Rajapaksa faced a new tidal wave of criticism. Sri Lanka's economy cratered. People are running out of fuel, food, and medicine. And observers are calling it Sri Lanka's Arab Spring. In a photo from one of the rallies, I saw a protester holding a sign quoting Lasantha. It said, "If we don't speak now, there'll be no one to speak for those who can't. Hashtag go home Gota." It's not a courtroom, but this accountability is harder to ignore. Neroli Price and I produced this show. Brett Myers edited today's episode with help from Andy Donahue. Thanks to Sean Musgrave and Jad Abumrad. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Arruda. They had help this week from Steven Rascon, Catherine Steyer-Martinez, and Jess Alvarenga. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kezar Kampwala. Sumi Agarwal is our editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising-Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja. Al Letson will be back next week.
If you like what we do and you want to help, well, it's pretty simple. Just write us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's easy and only takes a few seconds. Just open the Apple Podcasts app on your phone, search for Reveal, then scroll down to where you see Write a Review. And there, tell them how much you love the host. Your review makes it easier for listeners to find us. And, well, it really does make a difference. And if you do it, you will get a personal thank you from me. Like, right now. Like, thank... Wait, not him. Not you. Yes, you. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right.